nobody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world's changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children to jump the very best you can.
And good morning, the host, Dr. Perry Mason, the show, the house, and it's heard every Sunday right here on AM 690 WVON, the voice of the nation. And we are grateful to be here and grateful to be part of a radio station that has a longevity of over 50 years broadcasting to our community. And I'd like to say that I'm also very proud of being with them 30 of those 50 years. So I want to get started with our program. This is the first Sunday show, and it's always a show that we have that is dedicated to and sponsored by the University of Illinois Cancer Center. And representing the Cancer Center today, we have a gentleman. First of all, I want to congratulate him. I just understood he just defended his dissertation. I believe that's correct. And Doc, I want you to make sure that I say your name right. So I'm going to let you say it first. Doctor.
Good morning, Dr. Mason. This is Dr. Keith Naylor. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Dr. Naylor, it is my pleasure to have you here this morning, and we've got a lot to discuss. And we're going to be talking about the issues of the digestive system. And is that correct? Particularly cancer.
That is correct. Yes, I'm a gastroenterologist, which is a specialist in gastrointestinal diseases, and my particular focus is in colon cancer and colon cancer prevention and early diagnosis. So happy to speak with everyone this morning and really try to champion, you know, increased knowledge during Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month.
And actually, just not only just Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, but all the time. We can't
all the time. Absolutely.
Now, I'm going to take a little privilege here, because a gastroenterologist is something you and I are very familiar with, but I want to take a little time to just talk about the normal gastrointestinal system, and then we'll talk about what happens when we get these things that we call tumors, polyps, colon cancers, and things of that nature. Would that be okay with you, doctor?
Absolutely.
All right, let's just begin. Now, the thing that we call our digestive system starts obviously with our mouth and our teeth, but at the back of that, there's the throat and the connection that starts the food and the traveling down the digestive tract. Let's talk about the digestive tract, how long it is, where it starts, and we're all familiar with where it ends. But
we'll be talking about that too, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, but I want us to go through just, first of all, the normal system. So let's start with let's start at the beginning and literally move on down through the esophagus and small intestine, large intestine, so on and so forth. Would you mind, Dr. J, and then telling us a little bit about the function, if there are, of these parts of our digestive system?
Yeah, no, I'm happy to do that. So, you know, the digestive system is obviously one of the very, very important parts of the body, because it provides the nutrients to all the rest of the organs in the body. And as you mentioned, you know, the digestive system actually begins in the mouth. So even when we're initially thinking about food, you know, we're producing saliva, which has enzymes that helps digest, start the digestive process. And when we actually eat, obviously, we break the food up in our mouths, and then it travels down the esophagus, which is our swallowing tube. And a lot of the initial parts of digestion begin in the stomach. So most people are familiar with the stomach. It's kind of an organ that helps to hold the food and start digestion with acid, and that helps break the food down into smaller pieces. And then once the food is kind of broken down to a certain degree, it's allowed to empty out into our small intestine, which plays a big role in absorption of the nutrients that is within our food. And there's also enzymes, which are proteins that help to break down the different components of food, like protein, the carbohydrates, and the other components of the food into smaller pieces, which we can then absorb through our small intestine into our blood and provide nutrients to the rest of the body. And then what's left over after that, sort of the parts of the food that we can't fully absorb, most of it kind of the fibrous parts of food, that's what's left over, and that empties out into our colon. And our colon's job is essentially to kind of package that and absorb all the water out of it so we can get everything we possibly can get out of the food that we eat. And then, of course, what's left over is kind of the waste that we eventually eliminate from our bodies. But each part of the digestive system has an important role to play. And just, you know, relating back to our discussion about the Awareness Month, each one actually, unfortunately, can also be involved in the development of cancer. But today I think we'll be focusing primarily on the colon. But all those different aspects from your mouth all the way down through the digestive system has a very important role to play, and is something that we oftentimes as gastroenterologists talk to patients about different issues that can occur in those different areas and how they affect individuals and their quality of life.
So this is very important. Having had a colonoscopy and from a firsthand point of view, I think my last one. Since I've reached 73, I don't think I need another screening one. We'll talk about when's appropriate to start screening. So why don't we just go ahead and start with that as we finish? Because what's really important is people need to understand that this is one long tube that is in different parts. It's not, you don't have just an esophagus and then a small bowel. And then this is all part of one long tube that is differentiated in different parts. And so how do we, and could you just talk a little bit about how long those parts are and what things other than what you did in your very brief introduction, how important is their role, and what is it that they do or extract that makes this process successful?
Right. So in terms of the length, you know, the esophagus essentially is pretty standard in terms of its length. You can think about it starting in the back of your throat behind your tongue and then kind of going down to just above, you know, kind of your end of your rib cage. Right in the middle there. That's kind of how long the esophagus is. And its job is really transport. It's a muscle, so it helps when you swallow to push the food from the back of your throat down into the stomach. The stomach is, you know, not a particularly long organ, but it has a larger volume. So its job is really to hold the food and start to break it down and begin the process of kind of breaking down the actual, large pieces into things that actually could be absorbed. And really, when you think about the length of the small intestine, the length of the intestine overall, a lot of it is the small intestine, which is the part that does the absorption. So that usually is about 20 feet long, which when you think about it, if you laid it out end to end, is quite long. But of course, it's wrapped up within our bodies and it has the ability to kind of move around within your body. Sometimes you can hear it growling if you haven't eaten in a while or if you've recently eaten. And it also is a muscle that kind of pushes things from one end to the other. And then once things reach the colon, as I mentioned, it's kind of more of a holding area for waste until we're able to, you know, feel comfortable eliminating the waste. And that usually is about, several feet long, 3 to 4 feet long, about a meter, a little less than a meter in length for most people. So overall, you know, the digestive system probably ranges about 30 feet long or so if you laid it out end to end.
Well, this is good, because what I want people to understand is that these aren't separate organs. This is one organ that starts at the back of your throat and goes all the way to your anus. It's all one tube. It's different in different parts, and it does different things in different parts of the body, as doctors already indicated. The reason that I wanted to do that, because as we have this further discussion, about cancer. We're going to talk about where these things normally happen and what are some of the triggers, because cancer is just abnormal cell growth. So what are the things that can trigger? And the cancers can actually start in, and they can have cancers in your mouth. You can have a cancer in your cancers in your esophagus. You can have a cancer in your small bowel. You can have it in the large bowel, and you can have it in the rectum. So we're going to talk about each of those cancer stops so that you can understand why it's important and what your role is as the steward. In other words, your body contains these things, and you want to make sure you do the best you can do in taking care of these organs as they have to take care of you. So let's go ahead and start. You talked about the esophagus and the chewing, and why is the chewing important? Why is the chewing, there's a reason why this has to do this in order to get that before it goes down?
Right. So, in order for those enzymes that I mentioned to kind of get into the food, it's important that the food be broken down into the smallest pieces possible, which kind of allows all those digestive juices to mix in with the food that helps the digestive process begin. So, you know, in the mouth is where we do a lot of that, but some of it's also done in the stomach as well, because the stomach is a very muscular organ and moves the food around. And it really just helps break things down to a level at which the enzymes and the acid can really get in there and start to allow those nutrients to be released from the food, which are then later on absorbed into the small intestine. And as you mentioned, each one of those different areas, they have their specific role to play, and there's specific things that can happen in regards to, them maybe not working appropriately, or things like you mentioned, the development of cancer, which can also happen starting with the tongue all the way down, as you mentioned, to the anus. So we can talk about some of the risk factors that are specific to those different areas and things that we can do as individuals to hopefully help protect ourselves as well.
Why don't we go ahead and get started with that? Let's go ahead, because that's exactly where I wanted to go. So you were reading my mind through the radio.
Yeah, no problem. So starting with kind of the mouth, being at the beginning of the digestive tract, when we think about the mouth, some of the risk factors that we think of in regards to mouth health, of course, part of it is dental health. So keeping, we know that inflammation is a big driver of a lot of problems within the body, including cancer. So when you have bad, dental health, it can lead to inflammation, which can then lead to other problems. And some of the drivers of that inflammation, aside from things like, bacterial infections and such, can be things like smoking, chewing tobacco, or any kind of, toxin that we can introduce into the body that can lead to the development of inflammation or other sort of toxic materials being allowed to kind of sit on the lining of the mouth or, within the body. And then one other thing I'd like to mention is sort of viruses. We're learning more about how infections play a role in this as well, like the human papillomavirus or HPV, which is one of the risk factors for the development of oral cancer and also certain esophageal cancers as well. So those are some of the things, at least in the most sort of the area closest to your, beginning of the digestive system, that we think about as risk factors for the development of cancers.
And moving down into the small the stomach and small intestine?
Yeah, so the stomach, years ago, stomach cancer was one of the most common types of cancer. And some of that had to do with the way that our food was processed. People would eat a lot of salted foods and certain types of preservatives before refrigeration became very common. And it would lead to irritation of the stomach and the development of gastric cancer. And in some parts of the world, gastric cancer is still one of the more common cancers. One of the things we still have these days that is a risk factor for gastric cancer is a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori or H. pylori, which can sort of infect the stomach, which is unusual because the stomach is a difficult place for bacteria to live because of the acid. But this particular bacteria can set up shop there for even years. It can cause inflammation, even stomach ulcers, and then in some cases, stomach cancer. So there are a few cancers that we know of that are directly related to infections, and H. pylori are one of those infections that we know can cause cancers, particularly stomach cancer. And then smoking would be the other thing that is a high risk factor for the development of stomach cancer as well. So the more that we can avoid those kind of environmental exposures, the better.
And moving on down now into the small and large intestine.
Right. So the small intestine, you know, its primary job, as I mentioned, is absorption of nutrients. And it's not one of the most common places for cancer to develop, but it's certainly a place where that does occur. You know, so far, we really haven't described any of the places where we have a screening program set up in the United States where we recommend that, you know, normal, healthy people undergo screening. We'll get there. Really, the colonoscopy, or not just colonoscopy, but colon cancer screening as a overall is really the only one that we typically do routine screening for. But small intestinal cancer is something that we do see that can develop in people. There's different types of small intestinal cancers, and we don't really understand what drives one versus the other in many situations. But there are some small intestinal cancers that are more common if someone has a particular kind of hereditary or genetic kind of risk factor that can be passed down from a parent to a child. And in those certain situations, more rare cancers like small intestinal cancers can become more common. But in general, small intestinal cancers aren't very common. And then, of course, colon cancer, which is, you know, the awareness month we're in now, is one of the most common cancers across the United States. And, you know, it's a cancer that tends to develop from colon polyps, which are small growths that grow in the colon, not dissimilar to how moles can grow on the skin. And over years, these polyps can slowly develop into a colon cancer. And in those situations, it usually takes, you know, in many cases, multiple years. So the idea behind screening is to be able to catch these polyps before they actually are able to develop into a cancer, remove them, and that lowers the risk of someone, that individual, developing colon cancer.
Well, this is important, and we've talked about colon cancer on the show before. And I want people to understand there are some things that you don't have to be just a helpless victim. There are some things that you can do to make sure your gastric health is healthier. Because there's a ton of different things that are going on. I'm reminded by a paper that Dr. Michael Greger refers to, where a long time ago in the 20s, where women used to have intestinal stasis and have their entire colon removed, because what happens, they found that these women were at a higher risk for reabsorption of their bile acids, and then that being taken up into the breast tissue, causing breast cancer. So I say that only because it really, we need to understand the interconnectedness, and that's the point I wanted to also make, is the interconnectedness of these organs. They're not in the things that you talked about in terms of what you eat and those kinds of things. And of course, oral health and dental health are parts of that. We won't get into that, today, but we'll get back to that. What I want to get back to now is the polyps and what causes these polyps to grow. And is there something about the colon where they only grow there, or do they grow in the small bowel as well?
Great question. So, you know, polyps, a polyp is more a description of how the area looks, and it's essentially when the surface layer of the intestine starts to grow more than the surrounding area, and you sort of develop, you know, kind of an area that becomes raised or even sometimes grows into what almost looks like a mushroom, and we refer to that as a polyp. And it can occur, you know, across the digestive tract, and including in the stomach and the small intestine and in the colon. But the type of polyps that we worry about, we refer to them as adenomas, which are polyps that actually have some abnormality in regards to how that tissue is growing that could put them at risk of over time developing into a cancer. And those are a little bit more common in the colon than they are in other parts of the digestive tract for most people. So when we think about polyps, usually we're referring to the colon, but they can occur throughout the digestive system, and in some cases they can be a risk factor for cancer in other parts of the digestive system, but the colon is really the most common place that we find them and the most common place that they can unfortunately develop into a cancer. In terms of what drives the development of polyps, we don't have a full answer to that. I can say that there are a few things we do know. One is family history. So if you have family members like a parent, a sibling, you know, a first-degree family member, a close family member who has known polyps, these abnormal polyps or adenomas, or certainly a history of colon cancer, that may increase your individual risk as well. So there is some component that's genetic. We know that diet does have a role to play. So diets that are higher in fat, diets that are lower in fruits and vegetables seem to also drive the development of polyps. And then smoking as well, as we know, is a risk factor for multiple different kinds of cancer, including colon cancer as well. So those are three of the major things that we really focus on in our patients to really let them know about their risk and try to improve or lower the likelihood that they would ever, you know, unfortunately, you know, be diagnosed with a colon cancer.
You recently defended something. Let's talk about that for just a second. Successfully, I should say.
Oh, so I think what you're probably referring to is research that I perform. So, right. You know, I'm a medical doctor, so it's been some years now since I've had to do anything in regards to, you know, obtaining a degree. Thank goodness. but I do perform research actively with the University of Illinois Cancer Center that looks at how we can do a better job of reaching our communities to increase screening, in particular colorectal cancer screening, as well as working overall to try to increase the likelihood that if someone is diagnosed with cancer, that we find it at the earliest stage possible, which increases the likelihood that they'll survive the cancer, even sometimes be cured from the cancer. So some of the work that I do is really trying to focus in on family history, because family history is one of the risk factors that people are unaware of, but actually is one of the most important risk factors, both for the development of polyps and colon cancers. So I really, really try to go out in the community and talk to my own patients to really talk to their family members about not just colon cancer and colon polyps, but their overall family history of cancer and other diseases. Because within our community and communities as a whole, sometimes we're not as open about our health-related history with our family members. Many people tend to keep that very close to the, you know, chest and really not open up and express all the different things that we all experience. But it's very important because you can potentially make a big difference in the health of your brother, your sister, your son, your daughter by letting them know about your own experiences so that they can talk to their physicians and make sure they get the appropriate care at the appropriate time.
I really want to add something to what you said, because one of the things we talk about is getting family history. But the other, and I should tell you, and everybody knows me on the show, that I have a bias toward really focusing more on what we're eating, because we know what we're eating is and contributory to the diseases that we get. But what I'd like to for you to focus on is what are the, particularly you mentioned just a little bit about different foods, and the American Institute for Cancer Research has talked about the role that processed foods play in particularly colorectal cancer, that doesn't take much for us to be aware of it and some of those risks. It's one thing we need to talk about family history, but the other thing that's part of family history is that people in family tend to eat the same ways. Can we talk about that just for a moment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, in terms of the foods, both some of it has to do with, as you mentioned, highly processed foods are known to be those that tend to be the worst for our health in multiple ways, including as a risk factor for the development of cancers, including colon cancer. So highly processed foods, you can think about them as foods that kind of don't look like they looked when either they came out of the ground or they came out of the butcher shop. So foods that have been sort of developed more in a factory environment and created into the food. Like when you think about things like, you know, hot dogs or processed meats, or even foods that have a very long shelf life, like, you know, chips and sort of the snack foods that we have. Many of those are highly processed, and they're known to be connected with a lot of different kind of health-related risks, including the risk of developing cancer. We don't really understand necessarily exactly how point A goes to point B, but we do know that diets that are high in those foods tend to be higher in cancers. And then in addition to that, how we actually prepare the food seems to have an effect as well. So meats in particular that are cooked under a very high temperature, like fried or grilled directly over the fire, the development of sort of the changes that happen in the food when they're cooked under high temperature also seems to create carcinogens that could increase the risk of cancers, particularly digestive cancers. So we really try to focus on eating a diet that's high in fruits and vegetables, and also lean meats that are, you know, cooked in a way where it's cooked as healthy as possible. And that would be, you know, sort of grilled or baked, but not cooked under high heat like fried or, you know, directly grilled like charred.
Yeah, the American Institute on Cancer Research talks about, and we did a lot of work with this when this came out, you probably remember, but the pronouncement, this is about 800 scientists from across the world that came out with this statement, but they were talking about one hot dog or four pieces of bacon increase your colorectal cancer risk by 18%, as I remember the number. And I wanted you talked a little bit about that in terms of this processed foods. And unfortunately, we eat a lot of processed foods, way too many. And the other part of it is, what is the role now that children are being exposed to these kinds of foods much earlier and probably in much higher concentrations than they did before? Though I don't have data to support that. But even more because the availability of these processed foods are relatively ubiquitous. And the next point, you can respond to that. Then the next thing I want to talk to you about is constipation, because I was shocked to find out when you go in most of our drug stores in the community, you find walls of things for constipation. So could you give us some insight on why we have so much constipation, that we're spending millions of dollars a year as a country on medications for constipation?
And right. Go ahead.
And the other piece about the processed meats, because these are staples that we eat, many of us, every day. Bacon, and I don't know how they got to the word hot dog. But, you know, these are the things that the American Institute for Cancer Research have indicated are problematic issues. You want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think part of it is our lifestyle and our sort of on-the-go lifestyle, where we reach for things that are, you know, the fastest to prepare or the fastest to pick up. And those tend to be foods that are highly processed, because the processing of the foods allows them to be, you know, kind of heated up in a short period of time and then eaten as a meal, as opposed to taking a food, you know, directly that's, you know, raw meat or vegetables that are, that are sort of right in your refrigerator and kind of, you know, in the typical leafy green form. Those may take a little bit more time to prepare. So I think, you know, when we think about our schools and you know, our kids, you know, preparing foods and having our kids, you know, consume foods. For busy parents, sometimes they reach for the thing that's easiest to reach for, and that can sometimes be these processed or highly sort of pre-prepared foods. And, you know, we really need to get back to, you know, what our grandparents would recognize is food. And oftentimes that's food that takes maybe another step or two to prepare, but in the long run, it's healthier for our bodies because it gets back to what our bodies are most used to in terms of how we were, you know, for hundreds, thousands of years, those are the foods that we ate, and that's what our body's used to. So that's what we really should get back to in terms of our digestive health. And then with constipation, those are very closely aligned, because when you're eating foods that are more close to, you know, how they were when they came out of the ground, the foods contain a lot of the fiber and a lot of the different nutrients that the process of, you know, when they go through that highly processed kind of factory processing, some of that material is removed. So we would just increase our fiber even just by going and eating the foods in their kind of more native state. So that in itself would help with things like constipation, which in many cases begins because people have a diet that's lower in fiber, and the fiber helps to promote digestive contractions or motility in the digestive system, which helps move things through the system, which is what we refer to as sort of bowel movement frequency or you know, how often you have bowel movements, which is what we describe as, you know, constipation, when that doesn't happen often enough.
You know, can you also describe what is the role of inflammation in cancers? and in starting the process we just talked about.
Yeah, so one of the things, inflammation is a driver of, we're learning more and more, many of the things that we think of as disease are actually initially driven by inflammation, even things like heart disease, in some cases, you know, diabetes, and, you know, cancers as well. And inflammation, you know, because it causes damage, it sort of changes the way that the body and the tissues in the body have to respond. And this inflammation cycle leads to kind of an injury and healing cycle, where during that process, there can be things that happen that kind of make changes to the body, where the body isn't able to do its routine kind of, you know, the way that it would typically, you know, go through that healing process. And that can lead to small changes that over time kind of become bigger changes. And that's where the development of the polyps, or, you know, issues related to these changes in the genetics of the cell of tissue that can lead to the development of cancer, sometimes can start by being exposed to recurrent types of inflammation, whether it's from infections, like I mentioned, the human papillomavirus or HPV, or, you know, H. pylori, or in the case of the colon cancer, issues related to inflammation from sometimes inflammatory bowel diseases like Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, or, you know, we're learning that food itself may also drive inflammation through its connection with the bacteria in our system. So inflammation definitely has a huge role to play in the driving of sort of many different kinds of conditions, including cancers.
Well, one of the things I'm going to do is open the line so people can ask you questions. But before and while we do that, cue that up, I also wanted to talk about the role of other things like milk in terms of inflammation, if there's one that you wish to talk about or can talk about, and other things that we eat or drink on a regular basis that are parts of the inflammation, and the role that laxatives play, either in obviously helping us with our constipation, but are there some concerns that we should have about laxatives? So I know that's a mouthful, and I'll let you start.
Yeah, no, so milk, you know, it's interesting because obviously we've been using milk as a sort of highly nutritious liquid for, you know, many, many years, decades, hundreds of years. And in many cases, milk is thought of as, you know, sort of a healthy way to consume proteins and fats. There are some people who can have particular issues with some of the proteins in milk. I myself am lactose intolerant, which, you know, is where you don't digest, the lactose or the sugar that's in milk. I'm not aware of any direct relationship between milk and the development of, you know, cancer or inflammation in particular, but certainly if someone has a milk allergy, and there are things out there where people can be allergic to certain proteins in milk, that may be a driver of inflammation. But, you know, in many cases, at least right now, people are not recommending against milk, but we're learning more and more how each individual system may respond to different types of foods. So, you know, I can't say if that will change in the future. When it comes to things like other kinds of things that we would think of in terms of what we drink, the biggest thing would be alcohol consumption. So trying to moderate or limit alcohol consumption, we know has a huge impact on multiple different kinds of cancers. Things like esophageal cancer, stomach cancer, colon cancer, and liver cancer are all cancers that are known, and pancreatic cancer, are all cancers that are known to have a relationship with alcohol intake. So trying to moderate or limit your alcohol intake is, you know, an important part of overall health as well. So that would be one other thing I'd like to mention. And then when it comes to laxatives, you know, laxatives, as far as I'm aware, don't have a direct relationship to the development of cancer. But it's something where if you're using a laxative routinely to help with your bowel movements, it's probably a good idea to discuss with your primary care doctor or a gastroenterologist about why you're needing these laxatives so routinely, and if there's something else that might be going on, because there are other health conditions where constipation can be one of the presenting symptoms. Colon cancer is a condition where bowel changes sometimes can be one of the signs of the development of a colon cancer. It's not one of the most common things, which would be to see blood in the stool, but any kind of change in your bowel habits or any increase in symptoms is something I would always tell people to discuss with their primary care physician to make sure there's not something else that they would want to do testing on or to discuss further to make sure that there's not something underlying those changes.
Well, you've put out a ton of information. And you're at the University of Illinois, and I want to let people know what you do there, and if they have questions, or if they, or how would they access you, or what, or is this just research that you do, or do you do any clinical work at all?
Oh, I'm absolutely a clinical gastroenterologist. I'm always a clinical doctor first. So we have a whole group of physicians here at the University of Illinois Health and the Illinois Cancer Center. We all work together very closely. My particular role that I play within our team, so I tend to see patients who have a hereditary or familial risk factor for gastrointestinal cancers. That means patients who have a family history that's suggestive of something that may be passed along from a parent or other relative down to that individual that may increase their risk of a gastrointestinal cancer. These days, we have the benefit of having blood testing for patients that are, have a likelihood of having these issues. They can see what's called a genetic counselor, which is a specially trained provider that goes through their health history, and if they meet criteria, they can undergo a blood test that looks for whether or not there are changes within their DNA or the genetic material in their body, which could potentially increase their risk of certain cancers. In my case, gastrointestinal cancers, but it also relates to other cancers like breast cancer, prostate cancer, many other cancers we're finding have, in some cases, a risk factor that is genetic that can be identified through blood testing. And then that patient, if that's found, can be cared for specifically related to not just the average sort of guideline, but we can focus on making sure that they get screening at the appropriate time and as frequently as necessary to make sure we can ideally prevent or diagnose cancer at the earliest possible opportunity.
The number here is 573-591-1690. That's 773-591-1690. We've been having an excellent conversation today. And again, we want to congratulate our guest on the successful defense of his dissertation. That is a very important piece of information. And I know he worked his butt off to get that done. But pardon my Portuguese there, but it's really, we're very proud of you, doctor, for successfully defending your dissertation. And also, I want to say that you've been a great guest. And now we open the phone lines for anyone who has a question. The number again, 773-591-1690, 773-591-1690. Okay, so we're going to go, sounds like we got a bunch of people want to talk to you. So go ahead, caller number one, you're there with your question. Right ahead.
Yes, good morning, doctors. I have a question about colonoscopy screening. Me and my sister, we both had colonoscopies in the past, and we had polyps. Okay, and so we did our five-year colonoscopy. We both did not have any polyps, but my doctor told me come back in 10 years, but her doctor told her come back in 5 years. So I was just wondering which is correct, or does it depend on the doctor?
That's a great question. That's a great question. We'll hand that off to our guest right now. Go right ahead.
Absolutely, yeah. So one of the things, there are different types of polyps that can be found in the colon. Some of those are the polyps I referred to earlier called adenomas, and those are the ones that we, discuss as being precancerous or having the risk of potentially developing into cancer over time. And then there are other kinds of polyps which, we oftentimes will say are benign polyps. The name we use for those are hyperplastic polyps, which are polyps that aren't really known to have the risk of developing into cancer, but we call them polyps because they look the same as the other polyps, and really it can't be determined until they're looked at under the microscope to determine if they're the adenomatous or precancerous polyps or hyperplastic or benign polyps. So sometimes the doctor, when they do your colonoscopy, they may not know the type of polyp that you had until a couple of days after the procedure, when the pathologist looks at the polyp under the microscope, and then they can give you more accurate sort of recommendation about when your next test may be due. So it's possible that the type of polyp that you had versus what your sister had may be slightly different, but I always tell people to make sure that they keep their report after the procedure is completed that lets you know how many polyps, where they were, how large they were, and then ideally the pathology report, because those two pieces of information are what doctors use to determine when you should get your next examination. So it's difficult to tell you exactly what your doctor or why your doctor gave those two different answers, but the answer would likely be related to that report from the procedure itself and the pathology report that was from the polyps that were actually removed at that time.
Thank you.
Would they be able to bring their paperwork and set up an appointment to have a second opinion with you, sir?
Yes, me, a gastroenterologist. We have a whole team of gastroenterologists here at UI Health, and certainly I would be happy to do that. And it's something that we do frequently for people who have polyps and want to discuss when they should have their next recommended procedure. I should take a moment to say, colonoscopy is the most common type of colorectal cancer screening, and it's the one that we do for anyone who has a known personal history of polyps or a family history of colon cancer. For those who don't have either, sometimes they undergo a stool-based test like a FIT test, or you see a Cologuard talked about on the radio and TV. Those are two stool-based tests that look for colon cancer that don't require a camera or an invasive procedure like a colonoscopy, but are also done for colorectal cancer screening. But for anyone with a history of polyps or a family history of cancer or polyps, we recommend that colonoscopy, which is what we've been discussing so far.
And what would be your intake number for people who wish to do that? What number would they call?
So I would start off with just calling the University of Illinois Health intake number, which I don't have memorized, unfortunately. But if you go to any computer and look at University of Illinois Health, there's an initial intake number. And then if you they would take your information, you would let them know, your concern or the type of doctor that you'd like to see, and then they would connect you with the appropriate clinic. Sometimes, depending on, different factors, it may require an order from your primary care doctor to see a specialist like myself, but it depends on, some different factors. So I always tell people to begin with gathering their information, having all their insurance information available, and then contacting, our intake specialist that would then help go through that information and make sure that we appropriately send you to the correct person and gather all the information that would be necessary.
All right, let's go to our next caller. Caller, you on the air with your question. Go right ahead.
Hey, good morning, young people. Question for both of you all in terms of the black community. If you think if we eliminated drinking, alcohol, drugs, would you think we would solve half our problem and eat just a little bit better and exercise? Because I think when we don't say that drugs and alcohol is probably 90% of the problem in our community when it comes to health and smoking cigarettes. If we eliminate smoking cigarettes, drugs, and alcohol, do you think that our health and our community would do almost a 360? I leave you with that.
Doctor, you want to take that one?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a huge part to play. And interestingly, some years ago, there was a study that was done that included I can't remember the exact numbers, but a reasonable amount of African Americans that was performed at Loma Linda in California. And they were studying a group of people. Some people may be familiar with, there's a group of within Christianity called Seventh-day Adventists. And one of the big health practices is many of them kind of stick to a plant-based diet, and they kind of compared them to others who weren't on a plant-based diet, and the risks of multiple different cancers and other conditions was lower. So we do know, their practice is kind of an overall holistic practice, and I think it's not just one thing. It is really exercise, diet, trying to maintain overall good health, but it definitely has a huge impact And there's nothing about being black that causes disease. So it's not like being a black person means that, you know, a disease is bound to happen. But unfortunately, the, you know, historical sort of factors that have occurred have exposed us to a lot of environmental causes, and a lot of the social stressors lead to, you know, things like increased alcohol use, tobacco use, other kinds of drugs that also drive some of these health-related factors, even our diet. So I think that we do need to focus on the fact that there's nothing about being black that makes anyone unhealthy. It's, we can all, you know, try to do our best to live the healthiest lives possible. And in those cases, oftentimes we do quite well. So I absolutely agree that those are some of the cornerstone things that we as a community can really do to improve the health of our community.
I will add to that is that I did a talk for the Seventh-day Adventist, and I looked at both the Seventh-day Adventist studies. And one of the things that we found is that among the black Seventh-day Adventists, they were not getting the same total benefit. And when they looked at it deeper, is that there was a lack of adherence to the basic Seventh-day Adventist diet that was partly the reason for the difference. And to your point, Doctor, it had nothing to do with being black. It just happened to deal with whether or not you were adhering to the recommendations that were promulgated through the Seventh-day Adventist studies. Let's go to our next caller. You're on the air with us. Go right ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, young people. First, I want to tell the people, go out and look in the sky. You'll see them spraying the sky today. They spraying it with crisscross patterns, and after so long, the sky going to turn one color. Question to the doctor and many doctors like him. I hear very little about where is this cancer coming from.
All right. Well, we'll tackle that as best we can. I don't think we have a single source, but I'll let the doctor go ahead and take a stab at it.
Well, one thing I would say is cancer is not new. They found cancers in mummies from Egypt from thousands of years ago. So, you know, cancer itself is not something that's new. Now, certainly, there's certain cancers that are becoming more common. And I'll take this opportunity to say with colon cancer, we're finding it in younger people now more so than we used to, even though the average age of diagnosis is still around 65, it's become the number one cause of cancer in non-skin cancer in people under the age of 40, in men under the age of 40 in particular. In women, breast cancer is still higher. But certainly we are seeing that there's more cancers happening in certain populations, and it's something that we need to do our best at trying to get people into screening, letting them know knowledge about the cancer. Certainly best sort of lifestyle practices are huge, but screening is also huge. The one thing that you can do for yourself, because if you're already 60 years old, 50 years old, change your diet by all means, but get screened. Screening is the one single action that has the biggest impact on that particular cancer type, whether it's mammography, whether it's cervical cancer screening, whether it's colonoscopy. Definitely do all the lifestyle things, but screening saves lives. I've seen it with my own patients and my own family. So definitely do not, you know, undercut the importance of screening, even if you're doing all the important lifestyle-related factors.
And I would say in terms of those lifestyle-related factors, we have a generation where we've got more and more people eating less and less stuff that's cooked at home. And we're not eating the same amount of fruits and vegetables that we used to eat as we were growing up, especially when I was growing up. So those things we're eating way too much processed foods, and we're eating other processed things, highly processed. And those things have to have a role in it. Now, I'm going to have a show where we're talking about that. Let's go to our next caller. Caller, you're on the air with your question. Go right ahead. Thank you for that question, sir.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Yes, sir. Could you explain what is esophagitis, as well as what is the proton pump inhibitor recommended to combat it? I don't understand the relationship between the two.
Thank you for the question.
Sure. So anytime you hear something in an itis, usually it means inflammation. So esophagitis is inflammation of the esophagus. And one of the most common causes of that is acid reflux. So that's, you know, your esophagus connects to your stomach and the stomach produces acid. The stomach is designed to handle the acid, where the esophagus can sometimes be irritated if it's overexposed to stomach acid. So when people have esophagitis, sometimes it can be due to stomach acid, and they'll be placed on medications like a proton pump inhibitor, which is a medication that reduces the stomach's production of acid with the goal of reducing exposure of the esophagus to that stomach acid. So there are many different types of antacid medications that fall into this category. Some of the more common ones are like Prevacid or Omeprazole or Nexium, which is esomeprazole. There's others as well. But doctors oftentimes will put someone on a medication to reduce stomach acid with the idea of lowering acid exposure to the esophagus to allow the esophagitis or the inflammation to heal.
Is there a termination date on the use of the proton pump inhibitor? Is it just for 2 weeks, a month, or what?
Some of it depends on the risk factors that the patient has and, you know, what's known about the inflammation. So if it's severe, they're going to be on the antacid for longer. If they have what's called a hiatal hernia, which is where there's a little bit of a loose valve between the stomach and the esophagus, which makes it easier for acid to go up and down, then they may need to be on the medication for longer because, you know, there's a more higher risk of ongoing exposure. So the doctor would have to decide based on your particular health history what the appropriate timing would be. But in order to allow for healing, usually we're talking about several weeks to allow that area of inflammation to heal, you know, before we would recommend taking someone off the medication because the healing process can take some time.
Doc, I want to thank you so much for being with us. And you're going to have to come back because we got a bank full of callers. So you're going to have to come back. And I want to properly pronounce your last name again.
It's Naylor. It's like Taylor, but with an N like Nancy. So
all
Naylor.
Right, well, Dr. Naylor.
Yeah.
I want to really thank you for being, and you got to come back. You got to promise me you're going to come back, and we'll make sure that the powers that be make that happen. I want to thank you for being a guest and taking all those questions. And I tried to get some of them out of the way by starting with a few. But thank you very much. We really appreciate it. And we want to thank our listeners, WVON listeners. We always thank you. And the next voice you're going to hear is that of Ms. Pam Morris-Walton, who's coming to make a joyful noise over the radio. And until next week at the same time and station, may God continue to bless each and every one of you with continued health and strength as I leave you now in peace.